science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
Pretty good. How's it going with you?
All's well.
All is well, Dr. Lyle. It's pretty good, Dr. Hawk. You know, the interesting thing, the news of the week is the United States of America has had its election, and we are anxiously awaiting the certified results. So, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, take it away. What say you about this interesting?
Well, event? This is why you have a PhD in political science from Harvard for just times just like this. So let's hear what Jen has to say as you look at this whole thing. Jen, just give us a little feel of your survey of it.
Yeah, well, Doug and I had a good conversation with this morning for people who are on our membership site on the Living Wisdom Library. We actually talked about this on our membership, our weekly membership chat. And so people may have already kind of heard the points that we'll go over today. But I think the main thing that comes out of this whole experience, and anyone who's been listening to the podcast for any amount of time knows that they can come to the conclusion on their own that it's very likely that Doug and I voted for different candidates, even though we share a lot of politics in common, because evolutionary psychology kind of it really drags you into a more libertarian position, because it really communicates very effectively through behavioral genetics and just through individual difference. The fact that humans are individuals. Humans have individual preferences. They are wired up in very individual ways. We obviously have many, many things in common, but the pursuit of happiness that is so central to our entire premise of democracy is actually a very individual process. So as you come to terms with that through EP, I think it's really inevitable that it starts to seep into your politics as well, because you reach this point where you realize it's actually very tyrannical to impose your idea of the pursuit of your happiness on anyone else in the population at all, let alone the other half of the population that doesn't agree with you. So I think we have that kind of premise in common, even though we sort of drift over to the other sides of the bell curve in terms of our share not share dimensions and the other things that would sort of determine what party we're most affiliated with. And you know, I think the main thing, we're obviously nothing is completely official yet, although it's looking pretty official. I don't know how much of a chance that, you know, Vegas doesn't think there's much of a chance of this turning around. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I start to think that, okay, this is really happening. But what we were talking about this morning on the Q&A is that this is really amazing confirmation of how robust American democratic institutions really are. And when I say democratic, I say that with a small d, you know, small d democratic, small l liberal. Like this is the machine that the founders designed to be incredibly resilient to even really ridiculous unforeseen challenges and really toxic personalities in our leaders. So say what you will about Trump, but the guy is not the most presidential of characters to occupy that position. And we like to think that position is reserved for somebody who is much more presidential in character, even though that would be a little bit of a historical mistake to assume that everybody who's been in the White House has had that kind of gravitas. They have not. But no one has been under as much surveillance and scrutiny with that sort of bombastic, buffoonish sort of personality as Trump. So for us to get through that with the pressure of all of the media attention, all of the social media around it, and now to be in the midst of this very messy, contested situation with, a sitting president crying foul, like these are challenges that lesser democracies would not be able to weather. And we're doing really just fine. The process is working just as it should. People on all sides of this and on both sides of the aisle, including Doug and I, both have faith in the courts to do what the courts need to do to the extent that they are summoned to resolve this. And I'm not particularly worried about the outcome either way. I am an institutionalist first and foremost. So while I have specific personal political preferences that I would like to see echoed in my president, who is in that position is much less important than the upholding and survival of the institutions that preserve the process. And that seems to be very healthy, and healthier than I would have thought. So that's all good news from where I sit with my political scientist hat on.
Totally. I couldn't agree more. This is, I said earlier that I liken this to like if you heard that there was a new Steven Spielberg movie out and everybody told you it was a great one, you would be riveted because you know the quality of Spielberg and you know that if this is a great Spielberg movie, this is going to be phenomenal. And this is that equivalent. In other words, the Spielberg is the founding fathers. And that is the collective human genius that gave birth to a phenomenal country. What makes the country phenomenal isn't the Rocky Mountains and the beaches of Florida. It's the legal system is what makes it great. And at the heart of that legal system, it is how do you defend the transmission, and the selection of power, and how do you limit it? And so that took just almost unbelievable ingenuity, as far as I'm concerned, and negotiation to come up with the design that we have. And so this is now a moment, a Spielberg-like moment, where it's going to get challenged hard. Trump is not somebody that backs off from anything. So he is utterly shameless. You cannot cow him by embarrassment into anything. So if he thinks he's been cheated, or if he thinks that there's a way to use any system into his advantage, he will. I don't believe he'll do anything to cross the line. I don't think that that's in his DNA. I think what's in his DNA is to use every possible advantage that he can. And so now we, as Jen would say, you're not going to get challenges like this very often, but the whole point of the system is to be able to withstand whatever it is that can be thrown at it. And now we're going to get the kitchen sink. And so to me, it's a Spielberg movie. We get to sit back and watch the next 2 months, watch this unfold. And I have no idea, I can guess what I think is going to happen, but that's meaningless. In other words, what I get to do is sit back and watch the American system work under pressure. And that's a spectacular thing to observe. And I'm looking forward to it. As Jen says, no matter what happens, I'm looking forward to watching the process work. We're getting to see a historical moment. It's kind of like watching the last 4 minutes of a great Super Bowl. It's like, okay, now we're going to get to find out what happens. The referees are the best we've got in the league. We've got instant replay. We're going to do everything we can, and we're going to find out what happens. And somebody wins and somebody loses. And then I think everybody lives with it. Maybe not happily, but they do. I think then that's how I think this goes down.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, how many people, I think a big, big piece of the current debate, at least, the internet debate, is you've got a lot of people who were not old enough to remember the 2000 election.
That's amazing.
Live through it, weren't glued to their TV. Isn't that amazing?
I know. Yeah.
I used to, my opening question when I used to teach poli-sci, just to kind of get a sense of the room as an icebreaker, was what's your first political memory? And in the time that I was teaching, I sort of watched it go from, fall of the Berlin Wall up to, you know, it started to creep north until people started to remember, like, you know, Clinton's election. And then pretty soon it was 9/11, you know, they're just getting younger and younger all the time.
I guess the Chicago the 1968 Democratic Convention is not out there anymore.
Oh, that's funny. So you and I were similar ages when we had our first. For me, it was the Berlin Wall. So that was like the moment, or maybe the Iran-Contra hearings on TV. That was a big deal too. You know, sort of sitting and watching the Ollie North sit there and answer questions. So those were my formative moments. But yeah, I mean, I think most of these whatever we're into now, Generation Z or whatever it is, they didn't have that experience. And I don't think there are a lot of people, even Democrats, who are sitting around gnashing their teeth thinking that Gore should have been president and that this was all illegitimate and, you know, both terms of W's presidency were a sham and never should have happened and he was just installed by the court. That lasted for a couple of years. There were definitely people on the left who did feel that way and probably would still, if you press them, they would, that's the narrative that they would come up with, certainly W's first term. I don't think anybody really thinks of him as an illegitimate president. And you know, they might not like him and they might not agree with things, but that was, I mean, talk about a hotly contested, crazy, you know, down to the wire Supreme Court decision. I mean, that those were crazy times. That this seems much more civil and measured compared to that. So for people who just don't have that perspective, it's like, we've actually been here before fairly recently. And we got through it just fine. And it was looked like things were going to go to the other guy that time. And this is how it works. It just pivots back and forth. I mean, we were talking in the Q&A today, how a lot of Republicans are upset that some of their nominees on the court are not playing out like they were supposed to. You know, these guys are supposed to be very much in the party's pocket, according to the perceptions of a lot of people who vote for their president based on that idea. And really, judicial independence is a thing, and we want it to be a thing. We want those justices to get in that position and you know, follow precedent, follow their conscience, follow something that is outside of party affiliation. That's why they're there. That's why these are lifetime appointments. So we have these just beautiful, I mean, this is what checks and balances are all about. And nobody has been able to copy us as well as we came up with it. This is just an incredible system.
Yeah. All cool. All grand. We sit back and watch the movie. Popcorn. Yeah, and also I also spoke about this morning. I talked about how that the feelings that people have, and so the feelings that people have are vastly more intense than is warranted by the actual outcomes. That isn't unless you were I don't know, maybe you were some executive in an industry that was looked like it was going to grow large under Trump, and now it's going to have its wings clipped. Or if you're an industry that was hoping like crazy that Biden would win because you know that industry, that you're poised to make a lot of money. Very few of us have a significant direct relationship or correlation with our outcomes and any political process. The beauty of it is that at this point, the United States government, the United States, certainly federal government, actually any level of government, has surprisingly, the variances in how the government can work are almost irrelevant to the individual citizen. It isn't entirely true. If you're a developer wanting to build on the coast of Oregon and you built, you know, had 1,000 acres up there and you wanted to put a golf course in, and now the Coastal Commission, you know, is saying, no, you can't do it, even though we told you 10 years ago you could do it. You know, you've got a political mess on your hands, and your life, you know, may be very significantly influenced by that. But the vast majority of people do not have their lives actually influenced by politics. And that's because the decision-making powers of the government and the variances and outcomes of how the government makes decisions are in relatively narrow ranges, largely as a result of a very complex set of checks and balances that keeps the decision-making, as Jen likes to call it, little c conservative. In other words, not conservative politically, but conservative in the fact that it doesn't change quickly. However, your feelings don't follow that. And so it can be a little bit confusing I don't know why I have this scene seared in my memory, but some college football team lost a big game, like a national game, and they cut to the cheerleaders and they were crying. and I remember it was very you could tell it was a big thing. And of course, it does feel like a big thing. But the reason why it feels like such a big thing is because you feel like you're a member of a village that just went to tribal war. You know, if you're one of those cheerleaders, you're about to be one of the spoils of war. When the truth is, of course, God. I mean, that is exactly what's going on. So in the same way that if you're the member of the losing posse or winning posse in a national election, it's hearkening back to Stone Age processes where this was a huge issue in your life of leadership shift in a village of 40 or 50 adults. And your little coalition, if things go badly between your big guy and the other challenging big guy, then that's not so good for you. And that will have actually a potential significant change in your outcomes on some issues that are very important to you. Whereas, and you also feel very hyped up and agitated to try to convince everybody that your position is right and the other position is wrong. And the reason why you are energized there is because you believe that what it is that they think has significant meaning for outcomes for you that are important. Now, hopefully everybody can run the math. There's 150 million voters. Whether you convince seven people, you go out there and yell and scream and go 7 for 7 and flip 7 votes, it's not going to have any impact at all. But in the Stone Age village, if you flip 7 votes, it would have enormous impact. And so as a result, you have within you a feeling of imperative and angst about whether or not you can convince your friends and relatives and you know your stray Uncle Louie out there who is thinking wrongly and needs to vote for X instead of Y. That feels important to you, and you can feel incensed and frustrated and angry and everything else under the sun and desperate. In other words, you can have a lot of very intense feelings only because these intense feelings are echoing to Stone Age processes that were very important, as opposed to the current situation where the outcomes are, for all intents and purposes, irrelevant. I cannot honestly tell you, having lived through however many presidents I've lived through as a conscious human, my first consciousness about the presidency would have been with Jimmy Carter. So I would have been about 16 at that time. At that point, you're old enough to chew gum and walk and be drafted and all kinds of stuff. So but when I think about my life experience and what was happening on any kind of day-to-day or month-to-month or year-to-year basis, I cannot honestly tell you that my life has been in any way measurably influenced by any of the half a dozen presidents that have come since Jimmy Carter, since I was awake. And I think honestly, as I think you used a word, Jen, monitored. If you were to monitor your own internal experience and get a graph on it of the last 30 years of your life and try to chart whether or not when President X was in charge, you were 5% happier than when President Y was in charge, I think it would be absurd. There's no way that's true. Your future and your life is overwhelmingly dependent upon the esteem dynamics of your existing situation, not Washington politics. So as I tell those that are feeling, you know, beaten and panicked about this, it's like, relax, it's no big deal. And for those that just won, hey, enjoy the gloating. You know what I mean? That's all good. To me, it much more resembles a sporting event at this point than it does the life. And just as sporting events are mimicking life and death issues in a Stone Age tribal warfare, this is mimicking that sort of a thing, but it's not true. And so everybody chill out and enjoy the show, and you're about to watch the genius of the forefathers being tested, and I believe that they're going to do brilliantly.
Yeah. Now, truism in political science, too, is that, you know, what's happening at the level of the presidency or even at the level of Congress has much, much, much less to do with your real life outcomes than local politics.
Oh, yeah.
So your state legislature and your city council and your local, you know, school board, all of those. And it's this paradox in political science because participation and voting rates are just decline precipitously the closer to home you get. So, you know, people are much more likely to vote for president than they are to vote for their local city council rep.
Yeah.
When really that's the person you can actually access. That's the person you can lobby. That's the person who's making decisions about zoning and taxation and all these things that are going to really affect your financial life and also your all the little decisions about just anything, running a business and how you can socialize in town and COVID rules and all this kind of stuff. That's all local politics. That's not in DC. So it's really fascinating that we put all of our chips in with this thing that feels like it's this immediate, this is the alpha who determines our our welfare, when really it has almost nothing to do with you, and your life moves minutely 1 or 2 percentage points from administration to administration. Even under Trump, I mean, I would really ask people who are wailing and gnashing their teeth about how terrible Trump is, and I'm no fan. I've made it clear that I think the guy is a contemptible buffoon. But I am amazed by survey data, really good, robust survey data that I have seen that asks the most important question in presidential electoral politics, which is, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And most people this year say, yes, they are. They are in a better position than they were 4 years ago. You ask them, is the country better off than it was 4 years ago? They say no. So it's an interesting little split result. Mm-hmm. But the question that really matters for electoral politics is how do you perceive your station in life and your financial security and are you moving in a positive direction or not? And most people, according to that data, say that they are. And that's after 4 years of tyranny from Emperor Trump. So like life just does not move that much. We're in for the third term of the Obama administration. And if people are truly honest with themselves, life's going to be pretty much the same, maybe with a slightly higher tax rate, depending how much you're making, than it was for the last 4 years. This all of the rhetoric about this being a life and death election, the most important election of our lifetime. This is every single election you hear these things, every single time, going back in the early W days. I mean, for people who don't remember, the angst around W on the left was just profound, and probably more deservedly so than Trump, honestly. I mean, W was, he's sort of being softened by history now into more of a statesman compared to Trump, just based on Trump's more bombastic personality. But policy-wise, W was a much more, hawkish, warmongering, destructive to environmental rules. Like he was more active, or really Cheney was sort of behind the scenes. But all of that has just kind of faded in retrospect. And now it's like, oh, why can't we have a president like W again? So we have very selective memories about these things. It's like, my friends who are back in Alaska are always, every time I talk to them in the wintertime, it's always the worst winter ever. We've never had a winter like this. You know, it's never been this cold for so long. It's never snowed so much. It's never been this icy. They've never been this bad about maintaining the roads. And it's just every year, this is how we're wired. We have very short little time horizons as humans. We can't look back very accurately, and we can't look forward very accurately. We live in a very small slice of time and reality, and we are prone to exaggerating our circumstances.
Would that be just a sidetrack a little bit?
Yes.
I hear that story, and I'm thinking, like, does that have more to do with a less stable personality, or is that kind of globally around, no matter what, if we control for personality, that's how humans are?
The catastrophizing or et cetera over. Yeah, I'm like, certainly. Go ahead.
Yeah,
Yeah, my really stable friends on both sides, they're like Dr. Lyle. They couldn't care less. You know what I mean? They're just like, yeah, okay, our guy won or lost or whatever, and they're fine. But the ones who are less stable, they're like, oh my God, the dictator's coming back if Biden wins, and then, oh my God, yeah. Hitler's coming back if Trump wins. You know what I mean? It's just...
Yeah, I think the stability is a big, big factor in that whole story. And a lot of people who are, very wanting to get a lot of status and attention on social media are also, there's a high correlate with instability who are sort of grandstanding about these things, you know, i.e. this is the most important election of our lifetime, i.e. this is a matter of life and death for me. So, yeah, I think
the future of our country holds in the balance or whatever, you know.
Right. Right. I can actually remember 4 years ago talking to some people that called for help. And they were sweet people that were actually really, really worried about Trump coming into power. And they weren't being argumentative with the world. They were literally in fear. So they had essentially absorbed the worst case scenario, which is exactly what, you know, that's an early Stone Age reaction is, what just happened? It's bad. How bad could it be? You know, answer, could be terrible. And I reassured them, listen, this is business as usual. This is why you've got an extremely complicated formula in the United States government that essentially makes the president, if we had to look at the variances in policy outcomes and so forth, choices, I don't know, Jen, has anybody ever done this? I like to say that a president is worth 10 senators. I don't know. What do you...
Well, I think it's very much what you were talking about earlier, where it matters, you know, sort of party control of all the branches.
Right.
So if you've got, you know, the same party in the White House that you have in Congress, then you have a much more, quote unquote, effective tyrannical president that is going to, you know, enforce more of their interests and spend more money.
Yes.
You know, regardless of party affiliation. So you get these kind of gridlocked presidents who can't really affect very much of their agenda at all, which it looks pretty likely that Biden will be. Although Biden, you know, he's got a history. I mean, he was in the Senate for eons, and he's got a real deal-making kind of history with Mitch McConnell in particular, among others. And so if anyone can wheel and deal and make things happen, I expect that he would be able to. And this is what we want. We want compromisers. We want people who, you've got to remember, this is, you may have your preferences and believe that your way of doing things is the right way to do it, and the other guys are totally wrong. But you have to coexist in a country with those people. This is half the population. This is a tight election. This is unless you want to move to a more homogenous place where everybody believes the same way that you do and forfeit everything that is great about living in a more ideologically and culturally diverse country. This is the trade-off. You have to coexist with people who fundamentally disagree with what you want to spend money on and how you want to run the railroad. And so that is a situation that necessitates compromise. And so we want leaders who are essentially, in politics, we call this the median voter theorem. This is, you want people kind of coming to the center and finding as much of a compromise around these things as possible. And that's going to look like, you know, the needle moving one or two points. We don't want oscillating revolutions in this country. And the countries do not sustain atmospheres of revolutions followed by coups followed by, you know, sort of more revolutions. That is not the sort of place most of us actually want to live, no matter what your t-shirt says when you go to a protest. You don't want to burn it all down. You don't want to, you know, start from scratch. I saw some interview with some people at a protest that were like, oh, the American experiment has failed. Burn it all down. Start from scratch. Like, okay, I'm starting to feel like an old fogey telling the kids to get off my lawn. Like, do you know what you're looking at? Do you know how profound and amazing this experiment is, and how many other people on the globe would die for it and do die trying to get here and trying to recreate it in their own countries, in their own genuine revolutions? Like, that, I think this all speaks also to something that is kind of implied by a lot of what we're talking about, which is the fact that, you know, if a Trump election is a traumatic event for you, I would posit that you've led a pretty easy life. Like you haven't experienced a lot of real genuine trauma and difficulty in your life. If that's kind of the high watermark for the most difficult thing that you've ever gone through is the 2016 election, and you're carrying around a bunch of PTSD from it, then that is telling me like you've actually been very, very, very fortunate in your life. So that's just another thing to throw into the mix.
Dr. Hawk, thank you. Yeah. Consider me officially walked off the ledge. on the ledge.
The thing Jen was talking about earlier was a thing that I had heard about this and saw the numbers maybe 15 years ago in a paper showing that when all three branches, not the judicial branch, but the president, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, when they're all aligned, they spend more money. And
of course
it
they do.
Doesn't make any difference whether or not it's Democrat or Republican. They basically go after everything that they want. And so they end up spending more of America's money and driving it into more debt. When there is a check on that, then you wind up with a more fiscally responsible government. And so to me, as a libertarian, I want a more fiscally responsible government. So we now have a divided government, which means the brakes are on things. Everybody's going to have to compromise, and that's fine. I don't like it when there's three green lights in a row and they can ramp up a lot of speed. It happens, but it usually gets checked pretty quickly by a pendulum swinging political process. And so this is Jen's not an old fogey, but I am at this point. And so looking back over a half a century, when I've been bright enough to look at it, and then knowing now enough about the history, not just the history of the world, but also the knowing enough about the current world situation, and to know that there's, brilliant people, for example, by the SCADs in India that are working for $5 an hour. It's like, wait a minute, the world is so far behind the United States and Western democracies when it comes to standard of living. And part of that has to do with that they have not been politically appropriately organized for the last 100 years. And so they were not able to go through a capitalization, industrialization, free market innovation process. And as a result, they're in poverty, even though that they have mega talent. That is a great crime. So we get to sit back and look at the American experiment, as Jen explained to me, the first truly democratic system in history, and look at it and look at its brilliant outcome. And we enjoy it, all of us. And so so there's no need for any catastrophic thinking ever, really, in an American national election. It's a beautiful thing to watch the process work, and for us to be the beneficiaries of an extraordinary system. So, yeah, what a thing to watch around the world as you know that I've been to places where I know the talent is there, and yet the outcomes are tragic. And they're going to remain tragic for another 100 years. It's going to take a long time before the world sees a standard of living that looks like the United States.
Yeah, my favorite moment to come out of this was, leftist. I follow, my Twitter feed is really equally split between, it's why when we did the Q&A today, my hair is purple because that's my politics, a little red, a little blue. It's I'm just trying to kind of walk the line here. As people know, I have this like very strong leftist history, really was a card carrying Marxist for many years, worked for the ACLU, like really true believer. So I have come to this the hard way. Like I really, it's part of it is just age and wisdom. And a lot of it is evolution. evolutionary psychology and just libertarian thinking that has crept into my worldview through just ingrained now respect and deference to individual difference and individual freedom. Like it's, I don't see any more relevant or important value than that, and neither did the founders. I mean, that mm-hmm. was what the whole thing was built around. They were equally wary of oligarchy and popular democracy. Like the whole thing is this attempt to avoid the excesses of the king and avoid the excesses of the what would become the French Revolution, the mob.
Yes.
And so like, how do you design a system that avoids the worst tendencies of both sides of the bell curve? And they did a damn good job, and nobody has done it better. And it's incredible that it is held up so robustly to all of the crap that we have thrown at it. And so to see on Twitter these people who are just, you know, the ready to riot in the streets if Trump had won outright. and then when he didn't, and now partying in the streets, apparently COVID is over now because we can have big dance parties in parks and celebrate. But I saw somebody saying, oh, hooray, we've toppled a dictator. And it's like, you don't topple a dictator at the ballot box. The whole notion that you were able to volitionally vote the guy out, you know, through your franchise, like that's the opposite of toppling a dictator. You voted out a guy you didn't like, and that's what the process is. And so, yeah, people need to have some perspective and some gratitude. Damn it.
Yeah.
Little whippersnappers.
You
seriously.
Got it. It's very true. Yeah.
So this,
all right,
this brings us
go ahead.
So Dr. Hawk, you said about the share not share politics, and I want to get your take on this as well as Dr. Lyle's take on this.
Sure.
Are politics, these share not share politics, are they dynamic like esteem is? So, you know, as you know, Dr. Hawk, as you become more let's not use your as example, but let's say somebody mm-hmm. is on one side of the share not share, and then they mm-hmm. work really hard, they, you know, get to a particular place, they're in a much more stable position. Will their politics change to be more not share versus share if they feel like, you know, that they did it and they don't want to share their efforts?
Of course. Of
sure.
course. It's not going to happen every single time. You're going to have mm-hmm. some people who are not as subject to those changing incentives as other people. But I think the average person, as they see more and as they accumulate more things that are worth defending, including personal wealth and property, they become less Rousseauian and more Lockean. I think definitely mm-hmm. that is a way to think of it. They become defensive of what is valuable to them. Mm-hmm. And they're like, if they have worked their way up and they have earned something, then that is going to shift their politics. It's equivalent to, you know, we talk all the time about how Big Five characteristics are dynamic based on the context and the situation. So somebody can have X level of conscientiousness, but their conscientiousness is going to manifest very differently if they are working in a job with no responsibilities and no accountability versus a job where the stakes are very high and they have a big deadline and they have a boss who's breathing down their neck. So whatever the range of expression for conscientiousness is, it's going to express itself based on the broader context of that person's life. And that's the same thing with how prone they are in the share not share dimension. If they're impoverished and they're more interested in grabbing entitlements and, you know, payouts and, you know, easy living wherever they can get it, of course they're going to be, you know, cancel all student debt now and like, you know, redistribute and reparations and everything else.
Yeah.
Like that's a very different place to sit than somebody who has spent a few decades clawing their way up some dominance hierarchy, establishing something that they want to defend and protect and that they're proud of.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Dr. Lyle, what say you?
Let me think about, I mean, I don't, I think that's definitely going to be the case. And there's a famous, I forget who said it, obviously. I remember the first time I heard it was from George Will, probably 25 years ago. When he said, you know, the well-known saying is, if you're 20 years old and you're not a liberal, you have no heart. And if you're
right.
if you're And if you're 40 years old and you're not conservative, you've got no brain. And
yeah,
so,
I remember hearing that when I was 20, being like, whoa, fuck you, buddy. Like, what do you know?
And at 40 years old, right on schedule, I can remember, obviously, being in a social science PhD program, everyone is liberal. This is just how
of
it
course.
Is.
Yeah.
So it's liberals and libertarians and a few libertarians, but there isn't a single conservative in that section of the university. And I can remember me being a libertarian. I was always, you know, irritated at the leftist position of redistribution of wealth just generally. And I had friends of mine that were getting their PhDs studying, quote, poverty and how it all ought to be redistributed. And so this is, you know, that's who they, when you're in a PhD program in psychology, that's who your friends are. And so I can remember this amusement. I got my revenge for my irritation that one of my best friends from grad school called me up bitching at her first paycheck. Like she got herself a good job. And it was about $40,000, which in 1990 was, I don't know, like $68,000 or $70,000 now. You know, it was good, got a good job. I was proud of her. And called up, can you believe these taxes? Like I get them.
Yeah.
It was a moment of beauty. When suddenly the light went on.
I will also say on this topic, it's really important to note that people and their virtue signaling around these issues do not reflect their actual personal actions necessarily.
Right.
So I can certainly think of a lot of, you know, leftist professors and, you know, I'm thinking, I don't want to throw him under the bus particularly, but Steven Pinker, I don't know, did I send you this link?
Moments
after the election was called for Biden, he posted this like cringeworthy, like really cute, but also kind of cringeworthy video of himself and his wife dancing in their living room. And of course the guy has zero rhythm, you know, he's like, he's like dancing like, you know, that the AI program instructed him to dance. My favorite comment on it was, this video has more boomer energy than the atomic bomb. It's very, very cute. But so someone maybe not like Pinker, but other, you know, very leftist establishment figures will talk themselves blue about how they're in favor of redistribution and you know, oh, urban poverty and, oh, you know, racial equity and blah, 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 and all these things that they want to signal their allegiance to and their support of. But these guys are fully aware that the needle is only going to move one or two points in either direction. So they get to talk and signal as much as possible about how virtuous they are and how what big believers they are in redistribution
and
sharing the wealth. They want to share. They've worked hard, but they want to share it because that's what they believe in and that's what's really important to them. And then if we actually saw their tax returns, of course, they're cutting every corner and they're cheating left and right and they're doing everything else that everybody else is doing with any amount of wealth. But they can get away with the signal because nothing's really going to, their tax bracket is not going to magically double overnight, depending on who's in the White House. So, and they know that they've been in the game long enough that they know that they can do this. So I think that's a big piece of it, where it looks like you've got these intransigent people who their politics never change, despite the fact that they're older and wiser and they've accumulated a bunch of wealth. And it's like, oh, wow, that's a really virtuous person who just really wants to do the right thing. And it's really, there's some awareness. I'm just thinking in particular of some Harvard professors who live this life.
What does their internal audience tell them? I mean, is there an inference that can be made from that as far as their actions and their beliefs? Or
they're in an echo chamber, you know, so I think they justify it to themselves and they don't feel like they're doing anything super out of line. And they probably are given a bunch of money to charity and they're, you know, they're on the side of the bell curve that is sharing more relative to the center. But they're not sharing as much as they're broadcasting that they're sharing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. That's entertaining when you think about a LeBron James who, you know, by all accounts that I could see, I think I would like him very much as a person. I think he's an admirable human. I think he works unbelievably hard, and he is very passionate in his beliefs and his He's very much been an activist in the active African American community. All of that, you know, I can admire the human. However, if we were to scratch him politically, you know, we're looking at somebody who would be absolutely in favor of some major redistribution. You know, that's where, mm-hmm. where he comes from, where he lives. However, he wouldn't even out the salaries on the LA Lakers. There's no way. Yeah. Like, forget it. I get $35 million. You get $2 million. Go to
right,
go
that's
scratch.
Not fair.
Okay.
Yep.
And so this is. I mean, this is now what makes America great is the fact that we protect private property very well. We have a system that attempts to try to deal with the share not share dimension as well as we can. We wind up being centrist about it, so people can't defend a position theoretically, but they can defend it by feel. And so LeBron feels like he shares enough.
Mm-hmm. It's reasonable.
That's right. It's reasonable. And you know what?
Professor writes a nice check to the Planned Parenthood and the ACLU, and it's like, it's, you know, we're redistributing the wealth.
Yeah, that's like, right.
Doing what needs to be done.
Yeah. So, but at the end of the day, what we do is we protect, you know, we protect private property. We try to essentially have the government be as modestly interfering as possible to try to sort of feel our way to an optimum for how to have 325 million people live with a minimum of conflict. And that's what this big mess of a thing called the government is. And to me, as I've said, I mean, the alternative where we came from in frankly, what doesn't seem like a very long time to me when I look at history, you go back 10,000 years and it's a bunch of souped up, you know, chimpanzees beating each other over the head with clubs in tribal warfare. Okay. I mean, that's literally what you had. The most sophisticated thing on the earth that was created was a hand axe, more or less. So that's not very long ago. And so to go from there to where we are now, where we have to squabble and snarl about moving the needle 2% one direction or the next with our government, what a magnificent place it is to be in a time. And if you're concerned about anything, be concerned about your personal situation and your personal efforts and your personal goals about how it is to improve your life rather than worrying about the backdrop or the canvas of which that life is being painted. The canvas is just fine and it's not changing hardly at all. So your future is about you. And keep that in mind when we have all the exciting noise around.
Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you so much for the amazing analysis. I think I've been getting emails and comments, you know, about this election. I think a lot of people will appreciate your guys' take on it. So to our listeners, please do go to esteemdynamics.com because if you are a member there, a lifetime member or a monthly member, you can actually watch Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk's Q&A and previous ones as well that they do live, especially for the members there. And the cool thing is if you sign up for a lifetime membership, you get a copy of their new book. Their upcoming book. So Dr.
Lyle,
as soon as we finish it,
that's well said, Nathan. You got it.
Yeah. It's been a weird year.
All good.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.